Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Macro Trading Floor. This week, my friend Brent Donnelly is on holiday. So we're going to have a guest. We're still going to have two bold people on the show, which means the guest is also bold. I'm the second bold guy. But in the intro, before walking in the guest, I wanted to have just a quick overview discussing what has been going on this week in central banks world, which is quite a lot, to be frank. The first and most important thing we had is the Federal Reserve meeting. And what has happened there is that everybody was looking at the dot plot. And so the idea was, well, you know, we have had a couple of hotter inflation prints in January and February. So all eyes on the dot plot to observe what the median FOMC member voter actually would have thought the appropriate monetary policy should have been given the new incoming information. And so everybody was fixated on the 2024 dots, and they were looking for a change from three cuts this year as the median expectation from a member to two cuts, and that didn't happen. So the Federal Reserve kept three cuts in the 2024 dot, but importantly, they kept it there despite revising their core PCE inflation higher by 20 basis points through the end of the year. So now you have a set of economic projections from the Federal Reserve that sees core PCE at 2.6% by the end of the year. That's quite far off a 2% target. And nevertheless, you will have the Federal Reserve still going ahead with three cuts as their median expectations in 2024. So this was received by the market as quite dovish. This is basically a reaction function of a central bank that wants to proactively start cutting rates, even if the inflation path back to 2% is not a straight line, but it's quite bumpy. So that is seen as very supportive for risk markets. But actually what has happened after is that the dots in 2025, 2026, and the long run dots have been revised higher. So the Federal Reserve is also moving slowly but surely towards the camp of a structurally stronger economy in the US, which can handle a higher equilibrium rate. Nevertheless, they're still going ahead with three cuts this year. Again, seen as dovish by markets, because if the US economy is structurally stronger, if inflation is a bit hotter than thought, and nevertheless, the Federal Reserve is still going to cut, that is quite the proactively dovish stance, which helps markets rally. Now, the thing that everybody was expecting as well as a result is a weaker dollar. And the dollar has been weakening against financial assets, but it isn't been weakening against other currencies. That has been a surprise to many. But the reality is that if you look at other central banks, like for example, the Swiss National Bank, they cut interest rate as a surprise this week. You have other central banks like the UK or the Reserve Bank of Australia that are showing some dovish signs. You have Canada where inflation is coming down faster, and as well, the Bank of Canada is starting to talk about conditions that are appropriate to cutting interest rates. So the story is that other central banks are going to end up doing exactly the same that the Fed is doing, which is to cut interest rates, and perhaps they will be forced to cut even more than the Federal Reserve. And in that environment, it's very hard for the dollar to depreciate against other currencies if all other central banks are doing the same thing the Fed is doing, or they're acting even more dovish. Now, enough with the intro. It's time to walk in the guest of the day. So as promised in the intro, today we have a guest. So there are still two bold people on this podcast. One is me, the other one is not Brent, but the guest of the day, which is Dario Perkins. Dario, can you please introduce yourself for the audience who still doesn't know you? That's a crime, but please go ahead.
Yeah, so it's Dario Perkins. I work at TS Lombard. I spent roughly half my career in the UK Treasury, half my career in markets, investment banks, research, sort of macro research houses. And I have a sort of pretty broad remit. So I look at the entire global economy, probably specialize in central banking. So that's where I sort of spend most of my time.
And you're also the only guy that I would ever think of in the UK that has a picture of a midfielder of AC Milan behind himself. I mean, that's quite, what are the odds of that, man? You support Milan, you drink espresso the right way. I mean, you know, you're half Italian, basically.
Well, yeah, I'm half Italian, but also if you sort of go back to the sort of mid-90s in the UK, you couldn't watch any football on TV apart from Italian football. So when I was about sort of 8 or 9, I started supporting Milan. It went pretty well for sort of a decade, and then, till the global financial crisis, and then it's been this sort of decade of disaster with the odd sort of trophy. But yeah, I've been a Milan fan for most of my life.
Yep. So let's go to macro before we bore people out of death with football and Italian stuff. So I have to say that when reading back on your work, which everybody should read, by the way, it was quite the call to basically put out a thesis for which people would be scared of an upcoming recession in early 2023, but the recession wouldn't materialize for a bunch of reasons. You were actually right on quite some of them, but I want to ask you, can you please walk us through how did we manage to get here, 2024, with Fed funds rate north of 5% for 4 quarters, basically, and counting, 3 quarters and counting, and still not have any sign of material weakness yet emerging? How did we get here, also in Europe or in the UK, by the way?
Well, I think the sort of central bank mantra should be, if you can't be good, be lucky. And I think they've definitely been lucky over the past sort of 2 years. I'm not sure central bankers even really understand how they got to where they are today. It's not clear how things could have gone better than they have. I mean, they've got inflation down to not to 2%, but to levels that I think are tolerable. So if you go back sort of 18 months, I was talking about, the sort of revealed preference for higher inflation, that if as long as they could sort of plausibly deny that inflation was a sort of decent level, then they'd take that. And that's what's happened. They've seen this big sort of rebalancing in labor markets. So again, go back to the start of the tightening cycle, they were talking about the sort of fundamental imbalance in the economy that meant that inflation wouldn't go back to their targets over the sort of medium term. That imbalance has basically gone. They've raised interest rates aggressively. Nothing has broken. They completely dodged a recession that the whole world said was inevitable at the start of the tightening cycle. So in that sense, we're in a really good place. I think it sort of tells you that a big part of the inflation was transitory, a word that you're not allowed to
Ooh.
use anymore.
Yep.
But also, I think that the sort of rebalancing of the labor market that they've had, they've also had an enormous amount of luck there too. Because yes, high interest rates have sort of constrained demand for workers, but they've had this sort of big catch up in supply. So part of this is participation rates, which have recovered very strongly, and that sort of helped rebalance labor markets. But also, they've had really rapid immigration. And the countries that had the biggest sort of staff shortages 2 years ago have had the most immigration. So you've sort of solved a lot of these imbalances in the economy just through the supply side, which is obviously something that central bankers couldn't have controlled at all. I think when you look at the sort of impact of monetary policy, it's sort of, some parts of it are basically working as they should, and some parts have been much weaker. So I think of monetary policy as having sort of two broad effects. So the first one is sort of intertemporal substitution is the word in textbooks, which means that you sort of encourage saving, you cut off the supply of credit. It's about the sort of flow of borrowing in the economy. And that's basically worked. That has sort of worked as a textbook would tell you it should work. You look at sort of the rate sensitive parts of all of the developed economies, you've had these big contractions in housing activity, big contractions in construction and home building, big declines in real house prices, even if nominal house prices haven't fallen that much. And so that part is working, pretty much as, it says on the tin. The bit that has been much weaker than I think people expected is the second part, which is a sort of income effect of interest rates going up. So when you raise interest rates, you squeeze the incomes of debtors, you give them less spending power. And if that gets to extreme levels, then you start to see financial distress. So that's the point at which things start to break in the economy. You start to get bankruptcies, defaults, a sort of credit event is the popular term. And that bit hasn't happened. And I think the main reason for that is that first, we had a lot of deleveraging after the global financial crisis. So if you look at any country that suffered a banking crisis in 2008, has basically had a lot of household deleveraging and some corporate deleveraging. So it's sort of the really dangerous economies like Spain and the likes of those countries, they've basically adjusted. And then you've had this terming out of loans. So in the corporate sector, everyone has moved to sort of longer term, 7 year plus loans. In the household sector, that dependency that we had on variable rate mortgages back in the early 2000s has basically gone. And you've had this big shift into sort of long-term fixed rate mortgages. And so, the effect of that is that when interest rates have gone up, the real squeeze has been on banks because banks are on the other side of that sort of maturity transformation. So that banking crisis we had last year was a sort of wobble that reflected, what was happening in private debt. But for private debtors, there hasn't been an enormous squeeze. And so if you look at the BIS data on debt servicing ratios, and they publish these for every developed country, they have started to increase, but the increase so far is incredibly modest. So you're not squeezing debtors nearly as much as you did in the early 2000s. And as a result of that, you're not seeing financial distress anywhere, even in the countries that I described as sort of monetary canaries 2 years ago, the likes of Sweden, Canada, the UK to some extent, some parts of the euro area, the countries that are really vulnerable to interest rates going up, even those countries haven't had that sort of classic recessionary dynamic. So, did central banks know all of this stuff was going to happen when they started? Probably not. I think they panicked a bit about inflation. They imagined this sort of nightmare scenario where the 1970s would happen again and they'd look like complete jokers. And so they raised interest rates like there was no tomorrow, but they basically got away with it. So I think now, they look at this, they don't really understand how things have worked out so well, but they don't want to mess it up. So we now got central banks that are sort of desperate to ease policy. And so, they're worried that those sort of income effects, those sort of lagged effects on borrowers will eventually happen if they don't cut interest rates soon. So, we're on the verge of this sort of mid-course correction in monetary policy where they take back some of that tightening. And that's their way of securing the soft landing, if you like.
Securing the soft landing, those are pretty strong words. But the part that surprised me the most as well is whether for the US we could make a story, Dario. And you started already by explaining the fact that households and corporates have termed out their debt. I would add there is a very low share of floating rate liabilities for the private sector in the US. All the debt is basically in a fixed term, pretty much. So that means if you hike interest rates, you don't get a pass-through through floating resets, right? You don't pay LIBOR, well, LIBOR is extinct, SOFR plus a rate on the private sector. You just pay, you lock in your 30-year mortgage rate and that's it. And in other jurisdictions, that's not the case, right? When you raise interest rates, the pass-through through variable mortgages or variable corporate loans or borrowing is much higher. So we can make a story there. We can also say fiscal deficits have been used in 2022 and 2023 pro-cyclically, again, by Biden, like Trump used them pro-cyclically in 2017, for example. So that has helped the economy. Making the same story for weak links out there like Sweden or Canada or Europe or the UK, for example, it's a bit harder. I mean, you can't say that Europe has done a big amount of fiscal in 2022 and 2023. You can, but you can't say it the same way you can for the US. You can't make all these points. So let me broaden up the horizon for a second. How is it possible that even in these weakest links, say Sweden or the UK, for example, I mean, GDP is running at zero, roughly, but we haven't seen a recession in these places either. How would you try and explain that?
Well, I think there's some sort of temporary factors. So part of it is that you've had this big recovery in real incomes. So this was something that economists got the wrong way around. They thought, we have very high inflation, so the way to get inflation down is to have a recession. And what's actually happened is that inflation has gone down, and that's caused economies to recover because real incomes and real wages have started to rise again. So that big cost of living crisis that was particularly pronounced in Europe, but has happened all over the developed world, that's basically ended. And so real wage growth is now picking up. That's supporting consumer spending power. You've had fiscal policy, which is generally being quite supportive, although it's quite hard to know how supportive it's been. because, you know, because we've been in this sort of fake business cycle, looking at sort of structural budget deficits doesn't really work at the moment. You can't really tell exactly how much fiscal policy is changing from one year to the next. But in general, it's been pretty supportive. And then you've had this sort of very powerful bullwhip cycle in global manufacturing, which has also ended. So when we had that big rotation from goods to services demand, that gave you a global manufacturing recession and a global trade recession. You had this sort of overbuild of inventories during the pandemic, all that sort of double ordering and stuff that companies were doing. But that's basically ending as far as I can see. You know, the sort of bullwhip cycle is beginning to turn. Orders are beginning to pick up. So you've got the start of a global manufacturing revival. And those were basically just two big distortions in the global economy, which, as they've unwound, have helped growth to improve. So that's helping at the margin. I mean, if you look at the UK, you know, that was sort of one of the monetary canaries. But even in the UK, there has been some terming out of debt. I just worry that sort of you look at Sweden, you look at Canada, you've had, you know, a labor market that started out with very big staff shortages. So companies were very reluctant to fire anybody because it would be quite difficult to hire them back if demand picked up. And so you had a lot of labor hoarding. I worry that now we've got to the point where those labor shortages are basically gone. Interest rates are still high. The debt is beginning to mature. And so we're beginning to see a bigger monetary squeeze in those countries that I've described as monetary canaries. And those are the ones that we need to watch because, you know, there is still a risk that something goes wrong in monetary policy, that in some parts of the world, monetary policy is too tight, particularly those countries that were engaged in this sort of ridiculous reverse currency war with the Fed, where they just chased the Fed, you know, 75 basis points at a time. And so I'm still looking at those countries. You know, I worry that we could still see something start to break in those countries. But, you know, I understand why investors are obsessed with the US, because it's, you know, it's sort of systemically important for you for global markets. But if something was going to break, it was never going to break in the US first. It was always going to break somewhere else. So I just worry that we're quite close to that point. You know, particularly you look at sort of Canadian employment is beginning to crack. Swedish employment is beginning to crack. You know, there are some signs now that we could see the start of a sort of genuine recessionary dynamic. And so, you know, I think central banks will be key now to sort of prevent this from happening by pivoting and cutting rates.
Yeah, I love the explanation, Dario, of real incomes, because if inflation was not that much driven by aggregate demand boost by basically supply bottlenecks, once you reverse those down, then clearly you can have a pretty benign situation where real incomes start growing. And that has worked. But at the same time, I really can't square how the private sector that vulnerabilities in these places, say Sweden or Canada or Europe or the UK to a certain extent, New Zealand, for example, as well, how the private sector vulnerabilities have not yet resulted in a weaker economy, in a weaker labor market. In my opinion, it's just a matter of time, as in the positive effect have offset so far some of that weakening, but now there might be a point where the weakening becomes more pronounced. And so if you look at stuff like, I don't know, UK labor markets, European labor markets, but also Canada, Sweden in particular, they're even more vulnerable. I think those are interesting places to look at, especially also for trade ideas, because everybody's obsessed about trading treasuries and the S&P 500, but there are other assets out there. And as a friend used to say, a dollar of P&L that you make by shorting the Canadian dollar is worth exactly as the same dollar you would make by getting right treasuries or the S&P 500. So this is a way to say the opportunities abound in global macro.
Yeah, I think one sort of interesting dimension here is immigration. It doesn't really apply to Sweden as much. But if you look at Australia, New Zealand, Canada, you know, in the pandemic, they had these enormous staff shortages and these imbalances in their labor market. They then had this big surge in immigration. So they filled all of these vacancies with new workers effectively. And that sort of gave you a lot of resilience in the labor market. It kept your economy growing because employment was growing. Obviously, if you look at per capita GDP, it's gone down and there's been a recession in that sense. But you haven't had the sort of classic recessionary dynamic where employment starts to break and that feeds into spending and then it feeds back into sort of more job losses. We're not seeing that dynamic anywhere. But perhaps now, you know, as immigration starts to slow down and those staff shortages have been eliminated, and you know profit margins have come down. Maybe in some of those countries, we're now quite close to that point. So you know I don't think this sort of pivot in monetary policy, particularly in those parts of the world, can come soon enough, to be honest.
Tend to agree. And the fun stuff is everybody's looking at the Fed. It's just like, you know, there is a cliff and nobody wants to jump first unless the Fed
ECB
jumps first.
today. Did you see the ECB today? It says something like market sources say ECB doesn't want to diverge too much from the Fed.
I mean, it's
Independent monetary policy, that is.
yeah. I mean, the only central bank that actually went is the Swiss one. And these guys don't give a crap, right? They're very orthodox. They have their own thing. They're like, well, you know, I've been trying to weaken the Swiss franc, for example, for a decade, and I've accumulated just a trillion of foreign reserves by doing that. And you know, by the way, instead of buying bonds, I'm also gonna buy US stocks. I remember when they announced that they were gonna do that, they were like, what? And then, you know, they're very used to do very orthodox or unorthodox stuff or very decisive type of decisions without having to worry what the others are
No
doing, you know.
consequences.
Yeah, you know, they're just going to buy stocks in their foreign reserve management, or they're going to unpeg the Swiss franc from the euro overnight, like they did in 2015, for example. And now they're like, nah, we're not going to wait. We're just going to cut rates. We don't care whether the Fed goes first or not. But all the other central banks instead, I think they're all waiting for the Fed. And that can be a risk, you know, because you could be there waiting for another 3 months. And 3 months can be, a bit long for some vulnerable economies out there like Sweden or Canada. But coming back to US or Europe, let's say US for a second. Okay, you explained how we got here, but what is the path ahead? What are the odds you see for the path ahead for monetary policy and growth and inflation?
I think that the pivot is probably coming in time. So, you know, the central banks are quite keen. I think the fact that they've seen this rebalancing in their labor market has given them a lot of confidence that they're not going to get a second wave of inflation. So, you know, the rebalancing that they've seen, it tells them, number one, monetary policy is tight because they believe they generated that sort of rebalancing. Even if they didn't, they believe they did. And it tells you that, they're not going to get a second wave of inflation because you're not going to just jump back where you were 2 years ago with these huge imbalances in your labor market. So fundamentally, these guys still believe in this sort of Phillips curve framework. So they're not too worried about repeating the mistakes of the 1970s or the perceived mistakes of the 1970s, because I think the 1970s is a much more complicated story than just central banks cut interest rates too quickly. And so, you know, they're worried that, they've been pushing their luck a little bit with this level of interest rates. And so, you know, they are very keen to cut interest rates. And so now the hurdle for cutting interest rates is very low. If they cut interest rates quickly enough, they are going to, you know, dodge any further damage to residential property markets, commercial property markets, corporate debt resetting. So actually, I think that puts you in a really good place. You know, I think the sort of closest analogy is probably the mid-90s. You know, we had the soft landing, and then it was really a question of, you know, if you look at what Greenspan was saying, sort of 1995, 1996, the first rate cut was this sort of panicked response to a bad payroll number, which then got revised. But then the next cuts were basically because he wanted to give the economy a chance to grow. You know, he talked about not driving with one foot on the brake. And I think that's basically where we are with central banks. You know, they can see that the inflation is going away, you know, maybe not as quickly as they'd hoped, but it is going away. They can see that the economy is improving, but in a way that doesn't threaten to restoke inflationary pressures. Because, you know, one of the big benefits of inflation coming down so quickly and real incomes rising is you get an improvement in productivity. So I think, you know, you're beginning to see supply side improvements in terms of productivity, labor force participation, and all of this stuff is quite encouraging. It's the reason that, you know, Powell says he's not too worried about growth being too strong. You know, that's not a reason not to cut. So I think that's a pretty bullish environment, actually. I think this is similar to the sort of mid-90s. And I guess, you know, the thing that is going to scare people, given what happened last time I came on this show and talked about, gave you a market call, is I think that makes you quite bullish equities. You know, so there you go. You know, the Bank of Japan has hiked and Perkins has said he's bullish equities. That's the top of the market. I'm sorry.
Okay, I got to stop you there because there is a bit of history now we have to dust off for people who have forgotten this. So we are very self-deprecating on this
Some people
podcast.
haven't forgotten.
No, I think they have. I think they have. We're very self-deprecating on this podcast. Namely, we know we are wrong and we don't care because we admit it and we will never be right 100% of the times. People on Twitter are, though. So if you're looking for somebody who's right 100% of the times, just go on Twitter and you will find plenty of these guys. They're always right. We are not. We are right sometimes. We're wrong sometimes. And the last time Dario was with us, he gave us an amazing download of how a recession isn't gonna happen. So that was like, wow, I was listening, like, okay, he has some points. I never thought about this. And he was very vocal about some of these. And then he said, by the way, I think my trade idea is to short equities because everybody's gonna be scared about the recession, which was actually true, but equity markets didn't give a damn. And so that was actually almost the bottom of the equity market. And we were laughing about, oh, now Dario is bullish, so that must be the top.
Yeah, so I joked about my version of the SARM rule, the Perkins rule, which was when payrolls contracted, you had a recession. And somebody on Twitter wrote, no, that's not the Perkins rule. The Perkins rule is that you get the macro absolutely right and you get the markets completely wrong. Yes. And it was based on that. It was based on that call. You know, I thought that, you know, this sort of consensus for a recession that was going to build back, you know, my view back then, because people were looking at sort of leading indicators that were going to inevitably look horrible. I thought that that would spill over into market sentiment and you get, you know, a sort of big correction in equities. And obviously it didn't, because the market is much more rational than I gave it credit for.
Yeah.
And, you know, people didn't care whether there was going to be a recession or not, I think is where we stand. So this time, you know, I think there, you know, I think there is a decent sort of bullish case for equities. I guess, you know, as a Milan fan, I have this sort of bias for value. You know, we've lived through this sort of banter era where value's been completely destroyed. I don't get excited about the Mag 7 or, you know, Man City's of. And I, you know, so I guess my bias would be to sort of a rotation back in to the sectors of the economy that are more sensitive to interest rates and more sensitive to the real economy. But, you know, if this is the sort of mid-90s analogy, I don't think you could rule out a sort of bubble dynamic where the sort of AI thing just becomes, you know, a bigger thing. And if you look at the sort of valuations of those companies, you know, they're not particularly stretched, you know, by standards of the sort of mid-late 90s. So, you know, I don't rule out the prospect that it's just going to be, you know, driven by tech and it's going to be driven by AI. And perhaps we get that sort of, you know, melt up that we had in the late 90s. I don't think central banks will try to do anything about that, by the way. You know, I think, you know, the lesson of the last decade and particularly the last 2 years is that central banks cannot fine tune financial conditions. You know, sometimes they tighten, financial conditions tighten, sometimes they don't. People have this sort of belief that the central bankers can just fine tune financial conditions. And if financial conditions are easing, that means they have to do more. But you know, that's not their philosophy. You know, central banks believe that monetary policy is tight, regardless of what the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index does. They look at the impact their policies are having on the real economy, and they do not target asset prices. They never have. You know, that sort of Greenspan doctrine of, you know, you don't lean against it, but you clean up afterwards, that has very much survived. And so after the global financial crisis, you had a lot of soul searching from central banks. You know, they'd had this enormous bubble in the credit system. It all collapsed. You might have thought that they would change their approach to macroprudential policy. And they did, but they only looked at the credit cycle. So they said, you know, we can't do anything about asset price bubbles, but if there's a credit bubble, we should lean against that. Well, what we're talking about here is not a credit bubble. You know, you're seeing credit growth everywhere that is sort of moribund and not going anywhere. There is no sort of big increase in leverage. This would just be a pure asset price bubble, and the central banks are not going to stand in the way of that.
So, Dario, you're saying that if the Elizabeth Warren coin or the Joe Biden meme coin go up 9,000% in a weekend, Powell doesn't care, which I agree.
Weird, isn't it?
Well, I have to say that.
You know, I think that investors, you know, they sit looking at their screens all day, watching asset prices go one way and then the other way. And they assume that central bankers are sitting there doing exactly the same, you know, in sort of dark rooms, watching the lights on their screen flicker. And they don't. You know, when I worked in policy making, you basically got one market update at the end of the day. You know, this is what stocks did today. This is what, and so you don't sit there obsessing over, you know, financial conditions. You obsess over what's happening in the economy.
Yeah.
And a lot of these central bankers are sort of quite academically minded. And sometimes that's a mistake. But they are not going to get angry when Bitcoin goes up. You know, they are not going to feel FOMO when asset prices are doing certain things. That's just not how they think. And so in these sorts of circumstances, you have to put your sort of yourself in the mind of a central banker. And they just don't think in the same way as most investors.
So guys, you heard it here. Dario Perkins is bullish risk in general, which according to the Perkins indicator means that he will get macro perfectly right. But of course, his call will be definitely wrong. So you can go and do the opposite. Jokes aside.
So we're going to have a huge collapse in asset prices, but the economy will be fine is basically the message here. And the Bank of Japan hiking is also the other sort of contrarian indicator, isn't it? Because by the time the Bank of Japan gets round to hiking, that's usually when the shit's about to hit the fan.
That's true, actually. And also we have a stubborn ECB, which historically also serves as a great leading indicator that something bad is about to happen. You know, they in 2011 and in 2008, they ended up doing some stupid stuff as well.
You're a French president.
Yes. Well, don't get me started on French, please. I'm Italian after all, mate. But look, I mean, I'm making jokes about the Perkins contrarian indicator, but your work is awesome. Like, seriously, I don't read a lot of sell-side research. I also, when I was at ING, I wasn't doing that a lot, but I try to consistently read what you put out, and people should do that as well. So in case they want to read more about your work, where can they find you?
Best place is probably Twitter to start off with. You know, I tweet quite a lot. Usually I use Twitter as sort of thinking out loud. So usually I'm working on something and I've sort of put charts up or thoughts that I'm having, to get feedback. And it's not just a sort of stream of, you know, this is what I think is going to happen. It's more, I use it sort of discursive, but that's the best place to start.
Yeah. And what's your handle, man? Don't even remember.
Dario Perkins.
Oh, Dario Perkins. So one creative word of you. I'm so creative.
There you go. Easy.
So at Dario Perkins, you go in there and follow Dario on Twitter. And, man, it's been a pleasure to have you here. We'll try to get an update in 6 months when the stock market's gone down 20%. We'll get you back on the show, okay?
Not even funny.
Talk soon, mate. Ciao.
Yeah.
Oh, bye. By the way, before everybody leaves, there's going to be an outro session where I discuss about what Dario said without him being on the show, so I can, you know, talk all shit about him and he can't hear it, okay? That's how the macro trading floor works. So stay tuned for the outro. Been a pleasure to have Dario Perkins from TS Lombard on. Dario has given us a great download of how central banks were skilled and lucky, especially to get us where we are, with inflation quickly subsidizing, but at the same time, labor market holding on somehow okay. He also gave us a download of the risks that are lying ahead. And in particular, he gave us a download of the risks that are lying ahead for what I would call the weakest links out there. These are economies that have a higher level of private debt. These are economies that have a structure of their private debt being, you know, much more prone to potential mistakes or potential trouble. For instance, they have a higher share of variable rate mortgages, a higher share of variable rate loans, which means the pass-through of tighter monetary policy is much more rapid and intense over there. Some economies like this, for example, Sweden or Canada, are already seeing a bit of deterioration in employment figures. So whether something breaks and people are obsessed about when does it break in the US, Dario, but also I think that that is not necessarily the correct question. The correct question is, where does something break? The answer is not necessarily the US, but it might be in weakest economies that are more exposed to vulnerabilities coming from higher interest rates. And despite that, they're still trying to imitate the Fed and waiting until delivering the easing that their economies more desperately need than the US does. When it comes to the trade idea, we joked about Dario being bullish on equities because Dario being bearish on equities marked the bottom last time. But nevertheless, I think his main point is if the 1995s or 1998 vibes are going to resurface for a few more months, the euphoria and the animal spirits can run loose a bit further. That will obviously support stock markets, but the imbalances building when this euphoria gets to extreme levels can also be quite dangerous. an interesting idea if you are thinking of a prolonged bull market, like in 1995 to 1998 type of scenario, is to look at very long dated calls on the S&P 500, especially on the S&P 500 futures. You can get call options that are as long as over 2 years, sometimes 2.5 years expiries. And these very, very long dated call options are priced on the assumptions that the returns will follow somehow a normal distribution over the next 2.5 years. The reality is that if you look at long standing bull markets, sometimes you can get quite explosive moves on the upside, which makes these long dated options pretty wrongly priced because the set of assumptions behind these long dated options ends up being not correct, both in volatility or other drivers of option pricing. So long-dated calls, very long-dated calls, if you're interested in trying to play a prolonged bull market, can be an idea to put some premium in your book and in your portfolio without having to be directionally long the equity markets, which arguably is quite stretched and animal spirits are already running loose. Said that, this was it for the week. And next week, the show will resume back with my co-host, Brent Donnelly. So stay tuned, keep following the Macro Trading Floor. And importantly, please tell a friend. The Macro Trading Floor has restarted. We already have a large amount of people downloading the show and listening to it every week. If you find it valuable, please share this episode. Please share the word. The Macro Trading Floor is back. We look forward to having you again on the show next week. The content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.